This is Red Ice Radio. From the visible to the obscure. RedIceCreations.com.
Hi friends, good to have you with us today. My name is Henrik. Thank you for tuning in wherever you are around the globe. If you're joining us for the first time, this is the channel where we bring you fascinating and intriguing topics, interviews with authors, researchers, and filmmakers on all kinds of subjects that we think is vital that you have knowledge about. Please keep your browser tuned to RedIceCreations.com, our website, to follow us on a regular basis. You can stream or download. We have no commercial interruptions. And please go through our archive. We have over a year of interesting radio programs available for you for free. I'm sure you can find something that you've been hungry to learn more about. When you want to hear more, we have the second hour of our programs available in our members section. We have shows going back to 2006, and I hope you do consider getting access to many of the gems that we have in our archive. If you think we're missing something, we welcome your guest and topic suggestions as well. We do want to hear from you, so please stay in touch. Joseph P. Farrell has a doctorate in patristics from the University of Oxford and pursues research in physics, alternative history, science, and other strange stuff. His book, The Giza Death Star, was published in the spring of 2002 and was his first venture into alternative history and science. Following a paradigm of researching the relationship between alternative history and science, Farrell has followed with a stunning series of 14 books. He has been with us on the program three times before, and today he joins us to talk about his latest called The Grid of the Gods, tying in his thesis on the cosmic war into the mystery of the megalithic monuments that are found all over our planet. Please stay with us for a fascinating program. Welcome back to Red Ice Radio, Joseph Farrell. It's great to have you back with us once again. It's good to talk to you again. How are you today, Joseph?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me back, Henrik. How are you?
Excellent. You bet. It's great to talk to you. And obviously, as always, Joseph, you are pumping him out, as we should say. The Grid of the Gods is the latest one. I'm sitting here in front of me right now. I've been looking through your book in the last couple of weeks, actually, and skimming through sections of it. And really interesting. It takes off basically from your Cosmic War series, I guess, right? This is kind of like the backstory here, and there's so many angles that we can come to this from, but maybe you can just give us a brief outline in terms of the cosmic warfare, and in terms of, I guess, since this is focusing on the aftermath portion of that, maybe you can just give us the rundown of the cosmic war and what basically happened after that, Joseph.
Well, the Cosmic War was a book I did a few years back, and I really kind of intended that book as the keystone in the arch of all of my books. It really deals with a lot of physics and ancient texts and so on and so forth. But in a nutshell, it's my belief or opinion that what we're looking at very possibly is an interplanetary civilization that may have existed here in the solar system, and it literally blew itself apart. And I've always been intrigued with the idea or with the parallels between that civilization and the state of the world pretty much after World War II. You basically had the European infrastructure, particularly in Russia, but, you know, Eastern Europe and certainly Central Europe, that was pretty much blown to bits by the war.
Yeah.
And as a model, I took what happened after World War II, where you have surviving elites, the surviving Anglo-American elite, and in my opinion, some sort of survival of Nazism as an organized entity, and both more or less agreeing to cooperate after the war to pick up the pieces and reconstruct Europe and so on and so forth. Well, I kind of extrapolated backward after the Cosmic War. Well, what would happen if you had an interplanetary civilization that blew itself to bits? You'd have essentially the same things taking place. You'd have elites trying to preserve what scientific knowledge made their technologies possible and then trying to rebuild as fast as they could. And that's kind of where Grid of the Gods takes off, because it's my opinion that when you're looking at some of the megalithic constructions around the world, and in particular in Mesoamerica and South America, you're looking at a huge global construction project. That's Karl Munk's term for it, and I like the term because it's really the project of some sort of elite, and they're clearly out to preserve some sort of knowledge in building these structures. So that's kind of where Grit of the Gods fits into the arch of my books.
Absolutely, you bet. And as you detail here, obviously, it's easy when we talk about the global grid or cosmic grid, whatever term you want to use for it, that we look at people like Karl Munk and you know, John Michell, and I definitely want to talk about some of these people a bit later on. Tom Brooks is now the one over in the UK, but you kind of started over in the Nazi faction, if you will, then of this as well. You talk about people like Gerlach and Richter and other. Maybe you can give us a little background on that, Joseph.
Well, the reason it's interesting that you bring that up. I actually start The Grid of the Gods in Modern Times with the observation that early hydrogen bomb tests, and in particular the Castle Bravo test, which was one of America's early hydrogen bomb tests, they had calculated yields for these devices, Henrik, that were within a certain range. And when they set off these bombs, they were getting yields that exceeded their range, and in the case of the Castle Bravo test, actually almost double what the predicted statistical calculated yield of the device was to be. And there were, in my opinion, a lot of song and dance routines put out by the U.S. military, because the U.S. military eventually concocted this story that the Castle Bravo test ran away because American engineers had not calculated lithium-7 reactions into the thermonuclear stew. Mm-hmm. and the problem with that whole thing is that if you go back to what I wrote in Nazi International, the Nazi scientist down in Argentina by the name of Dr. Ronald Richter was already talking about lithium-7 fusion reactions, which were well known to thermonuclear engineers of the day, including the Argentinian scientists that interviewed Richter. So in other words, you have basically the military asking us to buy the story that they didn't know about the standard fusion reaction when they set off a hydrogen bomb. And, you know, I find that I find it totally unbelievable. I just don't think that's the case. I think what they're really trying to cover up, Henrik, is the possibility that when you set off these large thermonuclear devices, that for a very momentary period of time, the geometries in the explosion are literally kind of hyperdimensional transceivers. They're hyperdimensional gateways or sluice gates or whatever you wish to call them, and that they're transducing energy from the physical vacuum itself, from the zero-point energy, if you will. And that's exactly, going back to Richter, what he actually said to the U.S. Air Force, which subsequently sent people down to Argentina, notably after the Castle Bravo test, to interview this man as to what he was really up to. And he comes right out and says that plasmas, in his opinion, can be used as a mechanism to tap into the zero-point energy. And I think that's exactly what happened, and that's kind of how I start Grit of the Gods, because once you acknowledge the fact that a thermonuclear weapon and the explosion of it will for a momentary brief period of time gate energy into the reaction, what you're really saying is that they're hyperdimensional devices and that the fusion reactions themselves do not account for all of the reaction that's taking place. And I think you find the same thing taking place in the Soviet Union, because it's very notable to me that the Soviet astrophysicist by the name of Dr. Nikolai Kozarev had said pretty much the same thing. He had calculated neutrino yields from the sun that were not falling within the range of relativistic predictions, and he theorized that, well, we're getting energy from somewhere in the sun besides thermonuclear fusion. And the only way he could explain it was that it was actually gating energy from the fabric or structure of space-time itself. So you've got the Soviet Union essentially coming to the same conclusion.
So you have a whole chapter, obviously, called Thermonuclear theurgy, which takes us into another realm, obviously, of and this is what you're talking about. And the question right. I always had is this why certain tests have been done in, well, other people have been mapping this, certain, I don't know what to call it, geomantic, spots, basically, the White Sands area and so forth. And I don't have mm-hmm. a full list, obviously, of where all the testing has happened, Joseph, but I know that there's thousands and thousands around the world. And do you think that
yes.
this is why they've continued the testing, because they're actually trying to tap in or understand something more?
Oh, boy, what a great question. Yeah, I do think that. And you know, let's look at the recent entries into the nuclear club. You have France, China, Pakistan, India. These nations have continued their testing, and in France's case, atmospheric testing up until very recently. And I think this is exactly what they've all discovered. They've come up with their calculated yield based on the nuclear chemistry of the reactions themselves, and yet they're noticing probably that they're getting more yield out of devices depending on where they're tested, when they're tested. And they're probably testing, I think, in my opinion, they're probably testing these devices to learn exactly what the laws of this gating of energy into the reactions are. So I think this is, I think you're dead on there. I think you're absolutely right that this is probably the reason that they've continued the testing. And in particular, you notice that the more recent entries into the nuclear club are the ones that tend to do more testing. I think the United States and Russia a long time ago learned what some of these laws are, and that's one reason they haven't continued with testing of large-scale devices. But I think for the Soviets, Henrik, it probably came home with a really big bang when they tested that so-called SAR bomb back in 1961, this enormous, enormous hydrogen bomb with a yield of anywhere from 57 to 67 megatons, depending on which source you consult. And I think, given the colossal scale of that explosion that they tested up in the Arctic Ocean, I think that they probably figured out quite a lot about what we're talking about this gating of the zero-point energy into the reaction.
Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, to me it's been nonsensical try to understand why so this incredible amount of tests have been done. I mean, what can you measure with this? I mean, it blows up, right?
Yes.
But what more can there be? You know, it's like
yes, well, yeah, you know, yeah, all it takes to figure out is if you've designed a workable bomb is one test.
That's right. You know?
So I agree with you. I think that the real reason that they're setting these things off is not only to test different designs of bombs and wave mechanics that they set off and so on and so forth, but that they're really trying to figure out what these laws of harmonics are. How is the Earth grid, so to speak, or the testing of these devices on the surface of the Earth at particular times, how does this all affect the yield? Hmm. Now, I do want to make one statement. There is a school of thought out there. I'm not by any means the first person to have said this about thermonuclear weapons. Bruce Cathy has been saying it in his works for, oh gosh, almost 30 years now. There's another British researcher that's kind of picked up where Cathy left off and is saying essentially the same thing. I depart from these people in that both of them tend to argue that you cannot set off a nuclear weapon unless it's at certain times and places, and mm-hmm. I disagree totally. They will work regardless of where you set them off. What will change is the yield, depending on where you do it and what time of the year and what planetary positions and geometries are and so on and so forth.
Well, since these are such incredible explosions, maybe we can even compare them to, I don't know, weather systems. We can see that obviously a hurricane, for instance, is going to act differently at different times, depending on temperature, depending on solar activity, and a number of other variables in there, correct?
Right, and you raise another very, very important point, Henrik, and this is really kind of one of the keys to that book as a whole, and that is when we're dealing with physical systems like this, it's important that we remember that no physical system is closed, and most of physics, we've been treating things in physics as closed systems, you know, again, going back to the American military's reaction to the Castle Bravo test. They were treating the thermonuclear reaction as a closed system that was not going to be in relationship to other physical systems within the local celestial neighborhood, which is total nonsense. Every physical system is open to every other, and especially, as you point out, weather systems. They depend on a variety of factors, and I think this is the other key that they've discovered with these nuclear tests.
Now, I want to try to find the link here then, I guess, between the grid of these ancient megalithic sites that we kind of opened this up with, and then the weapons testing. There is some people out there have argued that certain weapons have been used to try to break up the grid, meaning that the megalithic stones in themselves, the relationship between them, the connectivity between them, is actually creating a kind of a layer, if you will, that is actually preventing us from going out into space. And some of these weapons have been developed as an effort to try to break that up. What's your thoughts on this, Joseph?
Well, I'm not familiar if with the theory that the grid was constructed to prevent us from going out into space. And in fact, I'll be very honest, in Grid of the Gods, I do not explore any particular theory about it. I'm simply trying to explore the fact of its existence, the fact of its ancientness, and the fact that it does embody, in my opinion anyway, it does embody a very sophisticated knowledge of physical systems. Now, if it was constructed for some purpose like that, then yeah, it would stand to reason that maybe some of these tests are designed to break up the world grid. But I very much doubt that for a very simple reason. It looks to me, Henrik, more like the grid was constructed perhaps for some stabilizing purpose. And the reason I say that is if we go back to my thesis of the cosmic war, one of the central tenets of my hypothesis in that book was that you had a planet within this solar system that was quite literally blown up as a deliberate act of war, and that planet basically now constitutes the asteroid belt. And as a result of that action, as a result of that act, you have a for all intents and purposes, you have a broken celestial mechanics in the solar system. And any civilization that survives that war is going to attempt to use its physical knowledge to sort of, if I can put it this way, to sort of restabilize the system. And I think that may, in part, be why the world grid is a world grid. In other words, why are we looking at, essentially, Henrik, a planetary machine? And I think it may have something to do with that. But again, the reason I wrote The Grid of the Gods the way I did, as a rather tentative exploration of things, is I kind of want people that do investigate The Grid of the Gods to slow down and take a more careful look as to what's going on, and to take a more careful look about the possible physics behind it, the harmonics behind it, and so on and so forth. I think eventually that's what we're going to discover, that one of the purposes of the grid is some sort of stabilization mechanism.
Yep, and we'll definitely get into that. I want to ask you more about, obviously, the relationship between certain sites and then some of the people, obviously, that you've drawn some of your material from, like Michel and Monk that we mentioned before. But before we do that, can we just quickly address this question that I have in terms of those who were behind the cosmic war, and if it could be the case then that we, as we see it here now on planet Earth, might not have been involved in that directly, or in other words, we might not be them, if you know what I mean, or is that the case? What do you think? Because we're talking about this disconnection, obviously, where we have no idea how some of these things were built, or how they were built, or even when, you know? So can we address that quickly?
Sure. It's always been my kind of working hypothesis that humanity has genetic cousins out there. In other words, I've taken the ancient texts that indicate that there's some sort of genetic engineering of modern man seriously and use them to hypothesize or to construct a big scenario. Now, in terms of the cosmic war, in terms of the world grid then, I think probably what you're looking at is a group of people, genetic cousins, so to speak, that survived that war and quickly set about to construct this world grid system after that war is over. And this may account then for the reason why in so many sites we don't have any real clear memory of who built these places. All we have in the case of the sites like Pumapunku and Lake Tiahuanaco in Bolivia, all that we have are local tribal legends. And it's interesting that if you look at these legends, Henrik, they're also telling you more or less the same sort of story. They're telling you that the gods built these sites, that the sites were abandoned because other gods were displeased with them, and then the Indian tribe showed up and took the sites over, essentially.
Yep, that's right.
I think this is a little indicator. This is a suggestion that we're dealing with a different group of people, and that we may very possibly be dealing with that group of genetic cousins, as I like to call them.
That's right. And so many of these sites, Joseph, are they still in operation? Are they still working? Are they doing the job that they were meant to do still?
Oh, great question. And my guess is that they're doing something, maybe not exactly what they were intended to do, because in the case of some sites, we're looking at the shell or the remainders of the machine, and I'm thinking particularly of Giza and particularly of the Great Pyramid, where it's very clear you have a shell of a machine there, but you that's precisely the point. There are things missing. All right. If you go to other places, however, like Tikal or Teotihuacan in Mexico and so on and so forth, I think you do have a clear case that they're doing something. I mean, my word, Richard Hoagland went to Tikal for, I think it was the History Channel or the Discovery Channel, I forget which one it was, and he took measurements with a Bulova Accutron watch, which uses, of course, a tuning fork to control the movements of the watch. And a tuning fork is a pretty accurate timekeeper because it's only going to vibrate within a certain narrow frequency band. Mm. Well, as he was taking measurements on and off the pyramids around Tikal, the tuning fork would vary in its frequency of vibration tremendously. So in other words, there's nothing really in special or general relativity that says that little tuning fork in his watch should do that, and do it particularly around structures like that. So we're dealing with a phenomenon that's, again, I think, a kind of an unknown phenomenon. We don't know what these structures are doing. We know that they're doing something in order to alter the inertial effects of something in regular frequency vibration like a tuning fork.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to, and this is one reason that I think we have to be very slow with the grid of the gods and investigating the structures on it. We have to take more measurements like what Mr. Hoagland took at Tikal. We have to measure all these sites with that sort of equipment. We have to take measurements at various points on the structures, you know, at the apex, at the base, inside and out, if that's possible, and take these measurements and begin to construct a real database about what these structures are doing. Until we do that, you know, all of us are really guessing as to what this grid is for.
Yeah.
My best guess remains, again, that it is that the grid is there to manipulate the waves, the standing wave structures within the Earth itself in some fashion. But we won't know how until we start doing these types of measurements that Mr. Hoagland was doing down at Tikal.
Now, the question is here how detailed we can or should get about this, because as we know, Joseph, there are thousands and thousands of megalithic sites around the world. Some more impressive, yes. Some more larger, obviously. But we're also talking about small things, little mounds here, a little passage grave, a stone circle. I mean, up here where we are in Sweden, there's tons of sites just in this small little area. And do you think we should include all of these together? Is that possible, or are we just talking about a selected few here? What do you think?
I think what you optimally, that's another great question. And I think optimally what we would have to do is construct an honest-to-goodness program. And, there would be layers to it. I think you would target certain selected sites, Chichen Itza and Tikal and Teotihuacan and Giza and so on and so forth. In other words, the major sites you would probably want to do first. But I don't think you're going to get a clear picture of what's going on these grid sites unless you also take measurements at places like Stonehenge in Normandy in France and there in Sweden. I know some of the sites that you're talking about there in Sweden. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I think it was Olaf Rudbeck, the famous Atlantologist in Sweden, that was fascinated with some of these sites, and rightly so.
It's interesting you bring him up. Sorry, Joseph, as I mentioned that, I recently watched a documentary about Rudbeck, and he's been, for obvious reasons, highly criticized up here for his belief, and he took it far, though. I mean, he mentioned that the whole Scandinavia was,
I know he took it really far.
Yes, he did. He was the propagandist of the king at the time, who were very interested in setting up Uppsala, as like the cradle of human civilization. But go ahead, Joseph.
Well, my real point is that we would have to do a thorough job of taking measurements at these sites on the world grid. We would quite literally have to take them at every major site, Serpent Mound and so on and so forth, Silverberry Hill in Great Britain, certainly, the Chinese pyramids, you'd want to take measurements there. Quite literally, you'd have to do a thorough job and construct what I think would be a viable working hypothesis for the grid. You'd have to take measurements at all these places. But I think the important thing is that Mr. Hoagland has shown that these sites are doing something. And, we owe it to understanding these sites to at least try to take more measurements as to what they might be doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I personally know John Burke has done a lot of good measurement. He has been measuring these with certain devices. Obviously, we have Carl Munk. He's done some great surveying work comparing the ratios between the sites. John Michel come maybe from a slightly different point of view here as well. Who do you want to talk a little bit about here? Where should we begin, Joseph?
Well, I think one thing that all of these authors are doing, I mean, you mentioned Jean Michel, and this man, of course, was fascinated by gematria and fascinated by sacred geometry and approached the world grid from the embodiment of certain sacred numbers within sacred geometry, approached the world grid from the standpoint of gematria and discovered that, and for those who don't know what gematria is, it's simply the idea that ancient texts have embodied within them numerical codes, and he would approach certain sites, Giza, for example, from the standpoint that the site actually was referred to in ancient texts and therefore has a certain gematria within those texts. And I think that approach is valid. Carl Munk's approach of surveying the location of these sites in relationship to a prime meridian that, in my opinion, undoubtedly runs through the apex of the Great Pyramid at Giza. In other words, the ancient world was very deliberately set out, and the world grid was set out with Giza being the prime meridian. And this, I think, is an unmistakable point. So, in other words, if we're going to construct a working hypothesis as to what this grid system is, just look what we have, Henrik. We've got, number one, a grid system laid out with Giza as more or less the coordinating center. Number two, many of these sites embody principles of sacred geometry and gematria. Number three, we know that some of them are manipulating inertial effects at a very profound level, given the measurements that Mr. Hoagland took at Tikal. So in other words, we are just beginning to scratch the surface. This is my real point in the book. We're just beginning to scratch the surface of how tremendously sophisticated this grid system really is. And I think, given the fact that you have all of this mathematical and arithmetical complexity involved in the grid, I mean, my word, Carl Munk alone, fairly well shows you that.
Yeah.
I think, given all of this, that we have to hold open the strong possibility, in my opinion, that we're dealing with a very sophisticated physics underlying all of this.
And obviously some of the evidence of this or for this that you've been detailing is the relationship between the sites. And in many cases, this has to do with physical appearance being the same. In some cases, it has to do with language. In other cases, it has to do with the mythology connected to the sites. So why don't we talk a little bit about some of the similarities in, you know, like visually or the architectural style, I guess, right?
Well, this is one of the very interesting points that Carl Munk raises, and I think when he raised it, he probably knew why he was doing it, although I don't know of any body of his work where he comes right out and says this. But let me give you an example of what he's talking about. He talks a great deal about the Mexican pyramids and the pyramids in Central America as being terraced or stepped pyramids, all right? In other words, they have lots of crenellated corners. They've got lots of facets, faces, steps, and so on and so forth. And one of the things that he very deliberately and explicitly says is that in order to understand the mathematics of these structures, you have to count corners and faces on these objects, all right?
Mm.
Now, when he said that, I had not read his work until researching Grid of the Gods, and my jaw just literally, it just literally hit the table. Because what he's really saying there is actually a technique known to mathematicians involved in higher dimensional geometry. In other words, if you were to take, let's say, a simple example like a tetrahedron, all right, and rotate the tetrahedron from 3 into 4 spatial dimensions, the way that a geometrician will actually work to deal with those kinds of dimensional rotations is precisely by counting corners and faces and vertices in a geometrical object in, 2, 3, 4, or however many dimensions you have. And the interesting thing is once you do that, then certain numbers begin to recur in certain patterns. There's a fascinating book out called Regular Polytopes by a Canadian mathematician by the name of Harold Coxeter, Coxeter. And he basically lays out in this book the mathematical technique for describing objects in 3 or more dimensions and doing dimensional rotations of these objects. And that is basically the technique that you use. So in other words, if we're looking at these fancy Mexican pyramids with all the crenellated corners, the terraces, the steps, and so on and so forth, the possibility arises, and it arises, in my opinion, very strongly, especially after Mr. Hoagland's experiment with his bull of a watch, the possibility arises that what you're dealing with are three-dimensional analogs of geometrical compounds existing in more than 3 spaces. In other words, you are dealing very possibly with objects that were deliberately built as kind of higher dimensional physics machines. They're built to resonate with objects existing in more than 3 dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way in 3 spaces that you can do this is by encoding the numbers of corners and faces in these objects. That's why I think you have, possibly, why you have the structures being built as they are. Does that answer your your question?
Sure does.
Am I way off target?
No, that's really interesting. So what you're saying is obviously that although it's built in 3D, it affects
right.
or maybe draws upon a higher dimensional energy, fourth, five. We don't know how far it stretches. Correct? It might go on and
exactly.
on.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm suggesting. In other words, I think that Mr. Monk, when he made this observation, he's a very knowledgeable arithmetician, and I can't imagine that he made this suggestion not knowing about this higher dimensional technique. And even if he did, the fact of the matter is that it is a technique of higher dimensional geometry. In fact, it is the technique that you would use in that kind of mathematics to rotate objects in three dimensions and into four spatial dimensions, five, six, seven, however many you want to have. Once you learn the technique, it's a matter of, again, counting corners and faces.
Yeah.
That's about it.
So does it matter? Is it the ratios, I guess? Is this scalable, Joseph, or is this to do with precise certain measurements? And if so, what would those be, do you think?
No, it is in the technique dealing with precise ratios and numbers that pop out again and again. For example, you have in a triangle, you have a certain number of degrees that all the angles in the triangle add up to. Well, then you rotate the triangle into a tetrahedron, in other words, from two into three dimensions, and all the angles present are going to add up to more and more numbers, but the numbers are all going to be certain harmonics or factors of the original 360 degrees of the triangle. So in other words, it's all harmonics. So yes, you're exactly right. It's going to preserve a certain ratio no matter how many dimensions you're dealing with. And the ratio, this is I think the key thing. And one of the things that grid research needs to start doing from this point on is it needs to start looking at these numbers and ratios in some of these structures very, very carefully.
Now, one that I know of who did extensive and detailed work on Teotihuacan is Hugh Harlston Jr. Have you
yes.
heard of his work? Can that be some clues in there, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. There are clues in there because one of the things that Harlston knows is that you have tetrahedral numbers popping out over and over and over again. Tetrahedral numbers, the most famous example being the number that Mr. Hoagland talks about all the time, which is 19.47, which comes from placing the tetrahedron inside of a circumscribing sphere and then overlaying a typical latitude-longitude grid over it. Well, depending on the axis of rotation that you place one vertex of the tetrahedron on, the others are going to be at 19.47 north or south latitude. As a universal geometrical rule, that will never change regardless of the size of the circumscribing sphere or the inscribed tetrahedron. This will never change. So Harlston, one of the things that pops out over and over again is that certain ledges or angles on the pyramid of the sun at Teotihuacan embody that number. If I recall correctly, and there are listeners out there who would probably be able to recall this right off the top of their head, but if I recall correctly, the avenue at Teotihuacan is offset by that amount of degrees from true north or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember exactly
mm-hmm.
how that works, but I think that's present in it. I think the actual longitudinal positioning of Teotihuacan is in some respect tetrahedral. It's placed at a certain distance from Giza, as is Tikal, for that matter. So again, yeah, Harlston's work is vitally important. And to his credit, I think the real thing that we need to remember about him, Henrik, is that his work was the work of an engineer. In other words, he understood that this complex, this compound, was laid out by some master engineers and master mathematicians according to some scheme, and in order to understand that place, you had to understand the mathematics of it. And it's all of that mathematics, again, Henrik, that suggests to me that Teotihuacan, like Giza, like Tikal, and so on, that these have some precise physics purpose, that it wasn't the happenstance occurrence of a primitive people building lots of pyramids so that they could practice human sacrifice.
Right, right.
I think that there was something deeper.
They're just tombs, you know, don't worry about it. I wanted to go back to the Giza question here again, and why it is that this was chosen, I guess, then, or maybe it wasn't chosen, it was just the natural or the obvious place for them to place the prime meridian. But why so? Why do you think that was?
Well, my principal hypothesis has always been that the Great Pyramid was a machine, and that the rest of the Giza compound was built over a long period of time according to a predetermined plan. I think that's a fairly obvious case. I think what you're really dealing with Giza is that you had a sophisticated civilization that realized, as engineers and surveyors later realized, that Giza was more or less at the center of the surface land mass of the Earth, and that's why it was chosen ultimately as a prime meridian. But I think, too, that the whole compound served some sort of machine-like function, and that whatever that purpose is, of course, my hypothesis has always been that the Great Pyramid may have been a weapon of some sort, or at least used as a weapon of some sort. If that be the case, then we may be looking at the rest of the compound having been laid out as kind of, as I've suggested before, some sort of stabilizing factor. Who knows? I think we're too early, quite frankly, in grid research to really be able to come up yet with a working hypothesis. We need more measurements. I think the spade work is done. I think that people like Michel and Carl Monk, even Graham Hancock and some others have done enough spade work now that we really need to start taking some careful measurements of these places and coming up with some viable hypotheses. One thing I think is clear, Henrik, we are, I think, dealing with an actual global construction program. In other words, I do think that there is an elite that was behind at least the planning of it, if not the building of it. In other words, that the concepts for this grid system were put into place and executed perhaps over centuries, if not millennia, of construction.
Yep, that's right. And I know that you bring up in the book as well Piazzi Smith's, the idea that Lower Egypt was the geographical center of all the land surfaces of the whole world. So could that be a reason why it was chosen as well for this particular device then, if you will, Joseph?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think so. And the other thing, it's interesting that you raise that point, because I've raised this as well, not only in Grid of the Gods, but in some of the other books that have touched on this. And that is the nodal points or the sites on the world grid that we're dealing with may have been nodal points for the interference of standing waves moving over the surface of the Earth. And in other words, let me give kind of a simple analog of what I'm talking about. If we take a bunch of rocks and throw them up into the air so that they'll come down on a smooth pond and sort of take a snapshot picture of the interference pattern of waves that those rocks make, that would be in effect what a standing wave is. So in other words, you have waves moving over the surface of the Earth that are going to intersect at certain key points along the surface of the Earth depending on the frequencies of those waves. So we may be looking too at a very sophisticated knowledge of where those intersecting nodal points of standing waves are. Now let me try and explain why those nodal points are significant. And this is kind of a difficult thing for people to envision in their heads. But if they can envision a bunch of arrows or vectors converging on a point, all of equal length or strength, then that point in mathematical terms is not going to be translated anywhere. In other words, it's not going to move from one point to another. But in a certain kind of mathematical analysis, there's going to be a lot of stress energy at that point that you're not going to be able to observe under normal mathematical linear algebra analysis, but you are going to be able to observe it in a different kind of mathematical language called quaternions, where you're dealing precisely with stress vectors in the medium. I think it's been my kind of working hypothesis for a number of years that on these nodal points of the world grid, that's exactly what you're dealing with. You're dealing with areas of zero translation, but infolded stress. You're dealing with waves canceling each other out at those particular points on the surface of the Earth. Mm-hmm. And that means that you're dealing with an enormous amount of energy locked up in those points.
And so that is the site where you maybe want to choose to harness that energy in one way or
exactly.
another, kind of like the John Burke showed in terms of the basically
yes.
charging up the seeds. And again, this might have been a secondary use then by the, if you will, then the natives of the area, correct? That this was
yes,
just one side effect of all of this.
Yes, absolutely. This may have been a system that they were using to draw power for whatever reason. It may have been even a system of communications, and this is the other important point for people to understand. We're dealing with longitudinal waves rather than Hertz waves, and the simple way to understand the difference between the two is a Hertz wave is the normal kind of electromagnetic wave that we're used to thinking of when we turn on our radio. So if you want an analogy of a Hertz wave, just take two people and suspend a jump rope between them and have one person jerk the rope up and down. Well, it's going to transmit an S wave from one person to the other. That's the standard Hertz wave that we use in radio and television. The problem is, Henrik, as we both know, is that a Hertz wave is a very inefficient means for transmitting energy. A longitudinal wave, a longitudinal electromagnetic wave, which is kind of the system that Tesla was envisioning for his wireless power transmission, is analogous to placing a yardstick between two people and having one person push or pulse the end of the yardstick. Well, the person on the other end is going to receive most, if not all, of the pulse that the other person places on the yardstick. It will transmit itself almost completely efficiently to the other end of the yardstick, and in addition to that, it will transmit it almost instantaneously. That's the other big clue here. So if they were using these longitudinal waves on the surface of the Earth not only for power, but they could also use them for transmission, for communication purposes. So this is yet another thing, you see, that is always tied up with these sites. They're some sort of temple where the priest or initiate or whatever has access, so to speak, to the oracles of the gods. Well, they may have been functioning quite simply as transmitters and receivers for communication purposes. So we're dealing, I think, Henrik, with a very, very complex phenomenon, and we have to slow down and investigate it very carefully.
Interesting. That's like our, electrical work or even the copper wires. There's multiple applications that we can use across them. We could, download
yes,
images,
exactly.
if you will. You know, we could talk
exactly.
over the phone or get electricity. So, yeah, I see what you
exactly.
mean.
Exactly.
Interesting.
Exactly.
So
we're dealing with a unified sort of physics, Henrik, and that means that the technologies that it produces is a kind of a unified technology that would be applicable under different uses. So I'm totally agreed with you there.
And obviously, as always, then that means that we might not even have a full understanding of all the applications that these sites were used for. There might even be a purpose that
exactly.
we haven't even envisioned yet, you know?
Exactly. This, and in fact, that's really the central issue here, Henrik, and I'm glad that you put it that way, because that's really the central issue. This is the reason we need to slow down with grid research and take careful measurements and come up with a hypothesis that's taking into account all the possibilities that may underlie this physics. It could be communications, it could be power systems of some sort, it could be weaponry of some sort, it could be stabilizing machinery of some sort. We simply don't know, and it may be all of them. You know, that's the other problem.
Right. So does this to you, Joseph, mean that whoever built these sites had access to another type of technology for a certain period of time, and then this was lost? Or do you think that it is one day we might expect to actually, you know, I don't know, dig up the machines from the Earth that actually constructed these sites? What do you think?
Oh, good question. In all honesty, I think we have to look at the possibility that we're looking at three periods of construction, and therefore possibly three different technologies. There's no doubt in my mind that the most ancient of these sites, Tiwanaku and Pumapunku and places like that, Baalbek and Lebanon and so forth, there's no doubt in my mind that we're looking at the products of some extremely sophisticated technology, for the very simple reason that we cannot reduplicate this stuff today.
That's right. Yeah.
That's the problem. So, you know, if we're incapable of doing it today, then the technological sophistication of whoever was doing this had to be very, very great. It had to be sophisticated. Then you have, I think, a later level of construction where the precision sort of declines. And Giza's the classical model of this. You have the Great Pyramid, of course, and then you have a slightly less ancient layer of construction with the second pyramid there, and the temples and so on and so forth. And then you have the third layer of construction at Giza, which is clearly Egyptian, of Egyptian provenance, and it is the most degraded technological level. I think that three-tiered level of construction you can find all over the world, because again, the technological sophistication of sites like Pumapunku in Bolivia is just beyond the imagination. This stuff is there's no other word for it other than bizarre. The stuff, apparently, in my opinion, was modeled by computers. They were modeled to fit together in some fashion, like complex three-dimensional jigsaw puzzles. The tolerances are nearly optical, and on we could go. Then you've got a slightly less sophisticated layer of construction there at Tiwanaku, and then you have the final third layer of Inca construction, which is very palpable and visible and not near the sophistication of the other two. So I think we're looking at a global pattern here. We're looking at kind of a three-phased period of construction. And not only does the technology decline, Henrik, the other thing I think that is in decline is the central scientific concepts or core concepts are being retained by all of these cultures, but by the time we get to Egypt, say, or to the Incas, or to the Mayas, or Olmec, or Olmecs, or what have you, by the time we reach those cultures, the core doctrines or the core concepts are being conserved, but they don't know why. They've lost the meaning of these core concepts. They're just passing down the mythology. I think that's particularly true in Egypt's case. The central concepts and meaning of them as a physics metaphor has been lost, and they're simply preserving the mythology. And it comes later, as scientific sophistication returns to mankind, we go back and we look at these texts, we look at these monuments, and we realize we're looking at a physics rather than a mythology or a metaphysics.
That's right. And interestingly enough, in certain cases, they connect, if you will. They describe the same thing basically, but in a different mythological wording, obviously. But there's clues within the mythology, right? So, but
yes, exactly. This is a topic that fascinates me, as you know, a great deal. You can look at the Vedas. You can look at Egyptian texts. You can look at Mayan texts. You can look at Neoplatonic texts, Hermetic texts, and so on and so forth. Mm. And the metaphysical or mythological language changes, but what interests me is that the underlying mathematical or physics metaphor doesn't change. That's what's really interesting about all this.
Absolutely, and I want to carry on in the second segment here to talk more with you about Some of the sites specifically, like Angkor Wat, you've done some interesting comparison in terms of Tikal and Madauri in India, and there's a number of these interesting sites, and obviously Puma Punku, as you mentioned as well. So let's hold off on that a little bit longer, and then we'll continue with that. But obviously, we want to mention and give out the title here again for the full story, as it were. Get a copy of The Grid of the Gods, authored by Joseph P. Farrell, and also co-author there, Scott D. DeHart. Anything you want to mention about your co-author, Joseph?
Well, yeah, it's good that you mentioned him. Scott is a friend of mine that I've known for almost half my life. He's a fellow survivor of the University of Oxford, so that's what brought us together. Quite literally, was our experience at that place. But his background is very similar to mine. He has a religious and theology studies background, and like me, he's come to all of these ancient texts kind of from a similar sort of pilgrimage, if you will. And a lot of what is in The Grid of the Gods, you know, is really kind of the product of conversations that we've had going back for years and years and years. So it's kind of a memorialization of conversations that he and I have had for quite a long time.
Interesting, very good. And the website, Joseph, is GizaDeathStar.com. On that website,
right,
people can find much more information. You have, I think, all your books lined up there as well, correct? There's a number of them now as well, of course.
Yeah, all the books are available for purchase on the website at the web store. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because I've been having trouble with Amazon with the web store for a couple of months, but I think we've got the problem ironed out so people can order the books right off the website once again.
Excellent. And of course, they all connect in a way. It is a series of books,
oh, yes.
but they kind of, they take, as we mentioned before, they kind of take off from the Cosmic War, the Giza Death Star series, obviously. And then you have a whole series on the Nazis and their, you know, occult activities, basically. And then now you've shifted your focus over to The Grid of the Gods. And we'll carry on then, Joseph, in the next segment to talk more about this. But once more, GizaDeathStar.com, that is the website. Go there for much more. Stay with us, Joseph. We'll be right back with more. We begin to discuss monuments underwater in the second hour for our members with Joseph Farrell. The major key point in the overarching thesis of planetary catastrophe has four different conflicting chronological data sets that we discuss. And this is in an effort to try to detail when catastrophe occurred and when the construction of the megaliths began. We discuss the interesting aspect of human sacrifice as well. Who was behind this practice and how does it affect the grid? Although it's been a prominent part of human history, it seems never to really completely have disappeared. Joseph talks about this in the context of the two surviving elites, the factions from the Cosmic War, simplified as the White Brotherhood and the Black Brotherhood, two fighting elite factions. The grid seems to have multiple functions, both as a stabilizing machine and an amplifier of some kind, maybe of thought or intent. We discuss similarities between the Vedic culture in India and the cultures like those who were behind the pyramids at Tikal in Mesoamerica. There are also similarities between Easter Island's script Rongo Rongo to that found in Mohenjo-Daro in India. We discuss the Prime Meridian, Angkor Wat, the zodiacal connection, and the image of Viracocha on the Sun Gate at Lake Titicaca and its intriguing resemblance to the three stages of the hydrogen bomb explosion. Joseph talks about this. We discuss the hunt for the lost ancient technology, evidence of ancient atomic warfare, Oppenheimer, Shiva, and the glass that was found on King Tut's breastplate, the desert sand turned into green glass with high energy. And this might be the same type of glass found in the Trinity site in New Mexico, where the first atomic tests were done. This is a fascinating continuation of our program with Joseph Farrell. Don't miss this second hour or any of our previous programs. Subscribe to RedIceCreations.com and get access to the members area. Don't miss this second hour or any of our previous programs. Subscribe to RedIceCreations.com and get access to the members area. It's only €5 per month. We have a 3-month recurring subscription option for you that we hope you consider trying out. You can also subscribe using our one-time option stretching from 3 months up to 2 years in case you don't have a PayPal account. All the details are on RedIceCreations.com. Click on subscribe or members to read more. Next up on Red Ice Radio, we have Pepe Escobar, Alan Apodesa, Gilad Atzmon, Ralph Ellis, Nick Bryant, Colin Andrews, David Crow, Peter Duisberg, Peter Dale Scott, plus many more. Keep listening to Red Ice Radio. We'll be right back here with more with Joseph Farrell. Thank you for staying with us.